obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name's Tina Albert and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here and be sober today. And welcome to those of you who might be new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I call her Dawn because I can. And I love you too. I was hoping you hurried up because I only have like an hour. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I don't say anything else tonight that you can relate to, I hope that you can relate to that. I'll start by telling you that it is an absolute honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at this roundup. Oh, my frickin' God. I cannot even explain to you the honor and the privilege that it is to be asked to speak at the South Bay Roundup. And I say that all the time. I get to speak quite often. And I always say that it's an honor and a privilege to get to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But this is my home gig. My sobriety date is October 10th, 1984. And our first annual South Bay Roundup was in 1985. And I was in my first year of sobriety, and I was an absolute frickin' train wreck. And you guys scholarshiped me, because I didn't have the money to come to the Roundup. And I worked in your hospitality room on the second floor, and I poured your coffee and shook it all over the place and spilled it on you and ran around screaming and yelling and making an absolute nuisance of myself and And so to be able to participate in this roundup and get to share with you guys tonight is, it's something else, I gotta tell you. It's like a full circle moment for me. So my sobriety date's October 10th, 1984. I got sober at the ripe old age of 20, of 25 years and some months and some days. And I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to you guys destroyed. And, when they asked me to speak at the young people's meeting, I got kind of a crack up about that because I'm not young anymore. So think I, anyway. But I came in here, and I got to tell you guys, long before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt so incredibly different in my own skin that it required me to drink. And the minute I picked up a drink of alcohol, something magical happened for me, where all of that separation and all of that difference and all of that loneliness just went away. And for my entire life, I remember sitting around the dinner table as a young kid, knowing that my mom loved my brothers and sisters way more than she loved me, and I'm an only child. I have this thinking problem where I just think about stuff that has no business being thunk about. Anybody else be able to relate with that? I just think about stuff. And I was raised in Manhattan Beach, and I felt so incredibly wrong from the time that I could remember. And I went to school over there, went to Penny Camp Elementary and Foster A. Begg Middle School and Maricosta High School and then Pacific Shores Continuation School, which I never graduated from either. But I went to school, and I remember looking at all of these little girls, and they were like 5 foot nothing, and they had long, flowing blonde hair and these sparkling blue eyes and these bitchin' little surfer chick tans, and they were just petite little perfect prepubescent Pamela Anderson pukes. And I was 5 foot eight when I was in the seventh grade, and I had long, stringy red hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And I looked at them and saw perfect Pamela Anderson, and I looked in the mirror and I felt like Pippi Longstocking with rickets. I was just like sickly and wrong. And we went to a gym class, and I remember how you got to start changing into your PE uniform, and I'm looking at all of these little girls, and they have designer clothes, and my mom would take me to the mall, and I would outgrow my pants on the way home. I think I invented the capri, and they have these perfect little lacy training bras and these little matching undies, and oh my God, they were perfect, and I put my training bra on backwards, and it fit me better. I mean, it just was nothing right about me, and So I'm in seventh grade, and I have my best friend, Carrie. And are you guys like, I don't know about you, but I was the perfect chameleon, and I would just, like, adapt my way into whatever I thought you thought I was supposed to be. And so at this particular period in my life, I was in the seventh grade, and I was doing the Pippi Goes Chola phase. And And I had this woof, like pitchfork reddish kind of hair and this black eyeliner. And I wore these dicky pants and these carpet slippers and polo shirts. And I was running all over Redondo Beach scribbling La Flaca R13 on the walls in pencil. And praying to God like nobody figures out who La Flaca is, right? And I'm just so wrong in my own skin. And so I'm hanging out with this girl. She's my absolute best friend in the whole world, and her name's Carrie. And I love Carrie more than any other girl in the whole school because she's Italian and her teeth are bigger than mine are. So she was like an instant boost to my self-esteem. So we cut school and we went to her house and we're drinking this scotch. We cracked the paper seal off of the scotch bottle and we started chugging. And oh my God, I hated that stuff. It burnt all the way down. It burnt all the way back up. It burnt when it flew out of my nose. It burnt when the top of my head flew off. I mean, it was just vile, nasty, rotten, horrible crap. And I swore I wasn't going to drink any more of it. And I watched my friend Carrie take a couple drinks off that bottle. And her face turned this glowy pink. And she wasn't worried about cutting school anymore. And for the first time ever, I intuitively knew that I wanted what she had. And so I started chugging that scotch. And something so profound happened for me that day that I chased it until I was 20 years old. And what happened was, for my entire life, I felt like I was on the outside looking in. Like there was this invisible bubble around y'all, and I was out there, and I could touch the bubble, and I could see you, and I couldn't get in, and I couldn't fit. And I took a drink of scotch, and for the first time in my life, I felt like I fit. Really, what happened was I didn't care whether I fit or not, but for the first time ever, I felt like I belonged, and that invisible separation between me and you guys kind of just melted away. And I got to tell you, in that first couple of drinks of scotch, what happened to me was the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous came true in my life, and I didn't even know what they were. And I could go down them like we read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I know a new freedom and a new happiness. And then I take another drink, and I don't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on the miserable 12 years that I spent on this planet without a drink of scotch. And I could go all the way down those promises where alcohol suddenly is doing for me what I can't do for myself. And so as a result of that, you know, my sponsor talks all the time about alcohol doing something for me. And if it doesn't do something for me, it'll never, ever do anything to me. And I think that's a pretty profound statement, because booze did something so profound that I was willing to trade everything that I loved in my life for just one more drink. So we dove into that scotch bottle, and I got to tell you what happened. A couple drinks into that scotch was my hair straightened out, and my teeth shrunk, and my boobs grew, and my freckles disappeared, and I absolutely felt like I was a part of the world, and everything that I thought was broken about me just melted away. And later on that afternoon, my mom was banging on the door because the school had called. We cut school, and I took a butcher knife. I jumped out the back window, and we were running all over Manhattan Beach, hiding from the cops, and they weren't even chasing us. And I was like Pippi's first grand adventure. I had so much fun. And we were climbing fences and hiding in doghouses. I climbed the water tower in Manhattan Beach, and it was just a blast. And about 4 o'clock, I knew I couldn't go home because I was in trouble. So I took my friend's 9-year-old brother, and I ran away from home. Because it seemed like the thing to do. I had one of those alcoholic brilliant moments, and off we went. And I stole a bike from the continuation school. I wrapped a chain around my neck. I put Sean on the handlebars. Had no seat on it, so I had to stand up and pedal. And about 11 o'clock, we had made it to East L.A., and I was out of scotch. And I was 12 years old, and Sean was 9, and we were cold, and I had no money. And so for the first and only time in my life, I called the police on myself. And they came and picked us up, and my mom came to the police station, and she was devastated. And I remember, like, from that time all the way up until probably a couple years into my sobriety, my mantra, my theme song was, leave me alone, I'm really not hurting anybody but myself. You know, if I really wanted to quit drinking, I certainly could, I just don't want to. And was anybody in here this afternoon when Tammy spoke? She was just rocking. And what she talked about was that invisible line that we cross between social drinking and alcoholism. And Tammy says she doesn't ever remember that line. I remember it vividly when I was around 12 and a half years old, and what happened was I snorted it. And and that's all I'm going to say about that. But like Tammy, she says she does everything, and I did too. And so I started drinking when I was young, and right after that, I did every single thing else that I could get my hands on. And my friend Giovanna up north, she describes it better than anybody that I have ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, I drank alcohol, and I snorted alcohol, I popped it, I smoked it, I fried on it, I shot it, I just loved alcohol. And I loved all of those other party favors too, and I normally don't speak about them, and that's really all I'm going to have to say about that. But what happened to me was I loved alcohol best. I absolutely did. And I ended up getting kicked out of Maricosta High School. I drank myself into and out of that school, and I drank myself into and out of Pacific Shores Continuation School, and I never went to school. I had no credits, and when I was in the middle of the 10th grade, my counselor suggested that I take the California High School Proficiency Exam because I had no credits and there was no way I was going to graduate, and so I did that. And I got out of high school and I went to El Camino, and I did the same thing there that I did at my high school. I went to the wall, the parking lot, the bleachers. I drank. I got high. I left campus before I got in trouble. And I had incompletes in all of my classes. And I got this job. I was working at the Burger King. I was a drive-through technician. And makes it sound technical. And I was hanging out the drive-through window, and I was drinking and smoking with a friend of mine in a car who I was giving free food to. They would drive through, I would feed them, and they would feed me. And then I turned around, and there was a Marine standing at the cash register. And I found out after I gave him my phone number that his name was Sergeant Dale Starkey, and he was a United States Marine Corps recruiter. And in case you don't know this, the only thing they want to do is recruit you. And I thought he wanted something else, but I was mistaken about that. I love guys in uniform. So anyway, I found out really quickly that Sergeant Dale Starkey had no intention whatsoever of recruiting me into his United States Marine Corps. But in 1981, he took me next door to the Navy office. And on the December 21st of 1981, I ended up in Navy boot camp. And I was 17 years old. And a half. I was the youngest person in my company. I was drunk every single day for a couple of years before I ended up in boot camp, and I was just an absolute nightmare. And I couldn't do what I was told, and I couldn't show up when I was supposed to, and I got in trouble when 5 weeks into my boot camp career, I got in trouble for drinking in boot camp, and I met the commanding officer. I had my first non-judicial punishment. They busted me and they almost kicked me out in boot camp, and they let me graduate. I went to A school where they were teaching me to be a cryptologic technician, and I was in naval intelligence. So I'm getting all of these top secret security clearances, and I'm drunk, and I'm leaving base, and I'm drinking on duty, and I'm doing this stuff that I don't want to do. You guys, I don't know if you can relate to that, but I used to do things that I swore I would never do, that I wasn't raised to do, that went against the grain and against everything that I believed in. And I would take a drink and I would do them anyway, and I would have no control over my own behavior. And I graduated from that school after having my second captain's mast in Pensacola, and they sent me to Adak, Alaska during the Cold War era. It's this little Aleutian island off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia. And there's like nothing to do there but drink vodka. And so I did that really well, and I worked for my commanding officer, and I was 18 years old. I had top secret special intelligence security clearances, and I wore my dress blue uniform to work every day. I sat in the admin office, and I was disseminating all this classified information. And I would leave at lunch, I would go get drunk, and and then I would come back out of my mind, and I would send this information all over the country to the wrong people. And you can't do that too many times, you get in trouble. And so they ended up sending me to the psychiatric unit in Anchorage, and I spent 21 days when I was 18 in the psych unit. And it was the first time in forever that I felt like I fit again. I got like a break and a little bit of a respite, and it was comfortable, and I had interesting conversations with bitching people, and nothing was expected of me. And I remember when they sent me back to the island, I cried because I had to leave. And then I went back to the island, and I ended up in rehab, and I was 18 years old, and they were trying to tell me that I was a chronic alcoholic, and I had this little counselor that had been sober forever, and I didn't understand. There were these little hospital corpsmen in there that were telling me that I was an alcoholic because of the things that I did, and because of the relationship that I had with my mom and the resentment that I had against my father and the fact that I quit high school and I didn't have a college education because I was drinking on duty and I got in trouble and I had boyfriends and my relationships didn't work and all of this stuff, and I didn't get it because they would tell me that I had a problem with alcohol, and what would happen was I would get a week or 2 weeks away from my last drink, and the only problem that I had was that I found myself sober. And if you guys think the way that I do and feel the way that I do and do the things that I do, sobriety is not an option. And so I would spend a couple days not drinking, and then I would get crazy. And the speaker over there tonight, before I came over here, was talking about that. Clancy describes it best. And he says that he gets sober, and it's like somebody sneaks into his bedroom and puts an invisible spring right in the center of his gut, which I don't know about you guys, but my alcoholism, it lives right here. At 25 and a half years sober, it lives right here. Right here is where, like, the air sucks out of me when I become uncomfortable, and I start feeling like I don't fit in again if I'm not doing the things that I'm supposed to do. But he says that somebody sneaks in, and they put the spring in the center of his gut, and every night they sneak into his room, and they tighten it just a little tiny bit. And after a while, that spring becomes so uncomfortable, I can't breathe anymore. And I need a drink just to take the edge off. And one more time, even though I swear I don't want to, I find myself drunk. And so I went through this rehab with them telling me that I had a problem. And anytime anybody told me that, I knew that they didn't understand. And I left that rehab at just before I graduated. I was there for just over 20 days. I was still on phase one, locked down, no phone calls, can't get any mail. I had no idea what they were trying to get me to look at. And all they wanted me to do was look at the way that I drank, and I couldn't do it. And so we went to this Phillies game on a Sunday, and my friend Mike and I snuck off to the bathroom, and we got a big beer. They used to sell, like, I swear there's a quart in there. And Mike was this big, huge guy. We snuck off, we got this beer, and we were on Anabuse. And I was thinking that because Mike was so much bigger than I, if he drank the top half, which was much larger by volume because the cup went up like that, that I could probably get away with the little tiny bottom half. And so he drank his, and I drank mine, and we just made it back to our seats. I spray puked five rows of Philly Stadium, and they quickly found out that I had drank. And wasn't the first time I had drank on Anabuse. It was the second time. The first time you do that, the Navy considers that a peculiar mental twist, and the second time they think it's grave emotional and mental disorders. But they kicked me out of that rehab, and they sent me over to the naval station to wait for my separation. And I was 18 years old, and they told me I was a chronic alcoholic, and I didn't understand where they were coming up with that information. As I was leaving, I was crossing the quarterdeck, and my counselor was standing there. His name was Jim Boyer. He was this little tiny old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a phenomenal man. And he grabbed hold of me, and he told me, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And I looked at him, and he had that look on his face like some of the old-timers have, where they just know you're going to never, ever do what you're supposed to do, and you're going to have to go die, and they're going to have to watch you. And it was this look of sympathy and empathy, and almost like he hurt. And I felt sad, and I knew he felt sad, and I left there, and I swore I was going to do this A&A thing, and I was going to go over to the naval station and beg to save my career. I was going to go to the neighborhood Alano Club in downtown Philly. I was going to ask this nasty old witch named Alice to sponsor me, and she was this chain-smoking old bat that talked like this, like a lot of those old-timers used to do. And I was going to get her because I was listening in the A&A meetings that they took me to in rehab. I knew you needed an old wench for a sponsor. And what happened was I left that rehab, and I don't know about you guys, I had this commitment, this firm resolution, like it talks about in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I swore with every fiber of my being that I was not going to drink, and I knew what I was going to do. And by noon, I was at the EM Club, and I was pitching quarters and drinking beer. And I was discharged from the Navy in July 15th of 1983, and I spent from that day until October 10th of 1984 drinking. And what happened was I left that rehab and I told everybody that would listen, I cannot be an alcoholic. I've never had a 502, DUI, whatever the hell you call them now. I've never been to jail. I haven't lost any families. I took that 20 questions that said, have you ever lost a job as a result of your drinking? And I put no. Like, I don't know what I thought the Navy was. Like, it's not a job, it's an adventure. But I didn't get it. And so what happened was I spent that year just crossing off every single thing that I used to separate me from you. And on the 9th day of October, I found myself living in this rockin' RV. It was a 1971 MG Midget, and I used to park down at the gas station on Manhattan Avenue. And I had no relationships left with anybody in my life, and I had nowhere to go. And I'm living in this little car, and I'm just dying a day at a time. And just like he was sitting in the seat next to me, I heard Jim say, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And that was that moment of clarity that they used to talk about in AA. And I got out of my car and I put a dime in the payphone and they sent me over to this little guy named Sam answered the phone. And he sent me over to Birch and Hawthorne. And I weighed 120 sucked up pounds and I had a little bit of jaundice and yellow eyeballs going on because I was suffering from hepatitis that I didn't know about until I had been sober for a little while. I have chronic hep C, which is not gone now, but that's another story. So I'm a little bit yellow. I'm crazy underweight. I got puke in my hair, and I got that rancid stench that takes like a month or two to wash out of your pores from living in my car. And I went over to this little Alano club in Hawthorne, and I walked in there, and I swear to God, everybody in there looked like they were 137 freaking years old. And they said things to me like, if you want what we have. And I thought, oh my God. If I want what you have, I'm certain I could take it, and I know I can outrun you. And I sat in those meetings, and they fed me orange juice and honey that was so thick that I had to chew it, and I thought it was punishment. And I looked around, and I thought, like, this is what it's come to. Like, I've drank myself here, and this is just where I got to stay. And I hung out in those meetings pretty much because I had nowhere else to go. And I don't remember what I heard in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I know I got a big book with about 20 phone numbers in it of people that I would not call to put me out if my ass was on fire. You know what I mean? Just not happening. I'm not calling any of them. And I left the meeting and I got into my car and I had a big bottle of vodka on the seat. And I got out of the car and I called this woman and I told her, and she said, go dump it out and I'll hang on. And so I dumped it out in the gutter in front of Birch, and I thought about lapping it up. And if I had a straw, I would have sucked some of it up. And I cried the appropriate amount of tears and I went and I told her I dumped it out. And I was waiting for her to say, good job, honey. Come on over. I'll feed you. You can shower. You could crash on my couch tonight and everything's going to be okay. And she goes, good. See you tomorrow at 5:30. And she freaking hung up on me. And
to obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I got sober in that school in Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys tell me that I should get a sponsor and that the men should work with the men and the women should work with the women and the men are going to pat your ass and the women are going to save it. And I thought, like, pat my ass, save my ass. So I asked this guy named Paul to sponsor me. And he was a 65-year-old, funky, gray-haired, eclectic, leftover hippie. And he had long gray hair, and he wore these bandanas and all this turquoise jewelry, and he had these black glasses. And I asked him to sponsor me because he was a dude, and I knew I could work him because he was a little old, and I thought I could cry if he was getting on me, and he'd, like, get up off me or something. And I was certain he wouldn't hurt my feelings, and I could talk him out of some money or whatever. And I asked him to sponsor me, and his size 11 went straight up my ass. It didn't come out for 2 years. And he absolutely saved my life, that old man did. And what he taught me was everything that I needed to know about Alcoholics Anonymous when I was new in here. And I didn't know that's what he was doing. He didn't sit me down and read me the big book. I had this lady named Helen that did that for me. And she grounded me in our literature, and she gave me a great background in Alcoholics Anonymous and our history and our literature. But Paul taught me basic stuff, like go to a meeting every day. Because I asked him, like, how long do I have to go to these silly little A&A meetings? And he said, every single day for the rest of your pathetic life. And then he died before he rescinded the order. So I still come to a meeting just about every single day. Paul was amazing. He had these gray-blue eyes that could, like, just bore holes into my soul. And he had this great Shakespearean English accent, even though he was from Inglewood, California. And I love that old man. He's been dead for 23 years, and there's not a day that goes by that I don't mention his name, that I don't think about him, and that something that he taught me when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous isn't relevant and applicable in my life today. And God, he was amazing. And the first thing that he told me was that I had to go to meetings every single day. And I remember I had about a week sober, and I was going to share from the podium over at Birch. And I got up there and I said, my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic. And he majestically arose from his seat and he said, that's all you know. Sit down now. And everybody clapped, and I was like freaking humiliated. I crawled off the podium and went and sat back down. And another time I'm at the podium and I'm talking, and he goes, you know, honey, if we want your opinion, I must give it to you first. You're finished now. And down I went again. And he had this way of just humiliating me in front of people. And, you know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about humility. It says through repeated humiliations that we begin to learn something of humility. And I think Paul took that like his personal conquest in life, to teach me humility through repeated humiliations. I mean, he just did stuff. And I would get up. I used to dress, for lack of a better term, like a little hooker. And I used to wear these... All of these great Al-Anon women would give me their clothes that they didn't want their Alateens wearing anymore. And so I would wear these little mini skirts way up to here, and these fishnets and these hooker heels, and then 1980s flash dance hair going on. And I had really low cut blouses, and I would clippity clop all over the place because I couldn't sit down. And I would get up and go get coffee and go get pee and go outside and smoke and go talk when somebody was reading. Because after all, like, you've heard that 17 times and I've memorized it already. What are you, freaking slow or something? And so I just couldn't sit there. And I got up one time and Paul put his hand on my knee and he pushed me back down into my chair. He goes, if you get out of that chair one more time, you better have piss dribbling down your leg. And all the old timers are going woo from the other side of the room, and they're high-fiving him after the meeting. And I just wanted to kill him, you know what I mean? I prayed for that man every day that he would just die, and he didn't, until he did. And then I wanted to take it back. Careful what you pray for, that's what they meant. But he taught me so much. That man taught me to respect myself. And he taught me to do that by making me lower my hemline and raise my neckline. And I got to tell you, I didn't want to do that. I love the attention that I got clippity-clopping all over the meetings. And no, everybody was paying attention to me when I was new, and I love that. And even though it's not really what I wanted, it's what I wanted. You know what I mean? We're such a contradiction in terms. And but I hung out and I went to these meetings. I went to 4 meetings every single frickin' day. It was miserable. And the only reason I did that is because I moved in behind the Alano Club. I just parked my car back there, and the 6:45 meeting secretary would come out and get me at 6. He'd bang on my window and wake me up, and he'd let me come in and wash up in the sink and drink all the coffee I wanted and eat all of the donuts before those Northrop TRW people came in their suits and their hair all fixed up, getting ready to go to work for their little attitude adjustment meetings. And I would sit there having, like, drank way too much coffee, and I would adjust their attitudes before I sent them to work. And what happened was, you guys loved me into sobriety, you know what I mean? I had no intention whatsoever of coming in here and hanging out with you bright, shiny, beautiful, freaking people for the rest of my goddamn life 24 hours at a time. It's not what I was up to. Not. But here I am, and what happened was I turned into one of those 137-year-old frickin' dinosaurs that used to hang out at Birch, and I gotta tell you, what happened was I frickin' blinked, and here I am, you know, and my life is amazing today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 6 weeks sober, and we have this annual old-timers meeting at the club. It's the Friday after Thanksgiving at Birch. It's still going on. And I went into that meeting, and I had this sponsor, and I had a couple friends that I was hanging out with in AA. And I went into this meeting, and I was dressed like I described you a little bit ago. And I sat in the very front row, so everybody could look right up my skirt. It was just charming. And at this time, they used to arrange the old-timers up on the stage in their varying stages of decay. And my sponsor's sitting up there with oxygen and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and Bob's got a prosthetic limb, and he's on a walker, and Helen's missing her eyeball, and they did that freaking tagline, like, if you want what we have, and I thought, Jesus Christ, no, I don't want a goddamn thing you guys have, and I really believe that. And just for a second, I realized for the first time in my life, oh my God, I wanted everything you guys had. And I didn't mean that I wanted the Cadillac that you guys had parked out front. And I didn't want Helen Louise's jewelry, because she got up to the podium with all of her diamonds and her full mink coat, and she draped her bling up here, and she said, I swear to God, she looked right at me, and she said, honey, wear your sobriety. And I looked down at my fishnets and thought, well, I am. But I realized, like, in that moment, I wanted everything that they had. I wanted that sparkle that they had in their eyes. And I wanted the way that Frank and Francie Priest used to interact together. How even though when they were mad at each other and sitting there like shooting daggers, and Frank would yell at her because he was one of them crusty old timers that used to say the F word a lot from the podium, and he would look at Francie and he'd do whatever. I wanted that relationship that they had, because I had no relationships left in my life that mattered. And I wanted that that ease with which they breathed. You know what I mean? I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so bound up, I couldn't freaking breathe. And I would sit in these meetings and feel like I'm breathing and there's no air going in, and I'm hyperventilating and I'm bound up and I feel like shit and I don't know what to do. And I got the sponsor, and he told me, go to lots of meetings. I went to 4 meetings every day, and Helen sat me down with her one little eyeball in the meeting room in between the meetings, and she read me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she read it really slow, one little stupid frickin' sentence at a time, and she looked up these words, and she explained to me what it meant. And she'd go, we're 100 men and women who have recovered, baby. That means we get better in here. We don't have to stay the same. Isn't that great? And I thought, it's just frickin' great, right? And so we read the big book, and Paul taught me what it meant to be an alcoholic, and I had no idea. He sat me down across his kitchen table, and he said, do you believe you're an alcoholic? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? I said, well, yes, I am. I was lying a little bit, but I said you, because that's what I was supposed to say, certainly. And he said, are you willing to make a commitment to yourself and to God never to pick up another drink for the rest of your life, 24 hours at a time? And I put on that bold face, I'm lying through my goddamn teeth look, and I said, well, yes, sir, I am. And and he said, great, what's it mean to be an alcoholic? And I told him absolutely what I believed. I'm an alcoholic because I've now been to county jail, had a 502, I'm homeless, I destroyed the relationship with my mom, I got kicked out of the Navy. I used to think I wasn't an alcoholic because I'd not been homeless, I never drank out of paper bags, and I had this vision of what an alcoholic looked like, and all of a sudden now I look like one of them. And I gave him all of this outside stuff that I thought made me an alcoholic. He goes, great. None of that makes you an alcoholic. And I thought, my God, old man, you guys need to make up your frickin' mind. You know what I mean? You're so confusing me. And he told me that you're an alcoholic because you have this mental obsession with a drink. And I kind of understood that, because from the time I picked up a drink, it's God, it's all I thought about. When I was drinking, I was thinking about how much I had left, who I had to share it with, where we're going to get some more, what we're going to do when we're drinking. When I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about where I'm coming up with some, who I got to share it with, how I can have yours because I'm out, and all of this funky stuff. And it's all I thought about was drinking. And so he explained to me that that was his mental obsession that our literature talks about. And then he told me that I had a physical allergy that manifested in something called the phenomenon of craving. And once I took one drink of alcohol into my body, I craved another one. And I kind of got that, because I don't know about you guys, I never, ever, ever took one social drink in my life. From the time I picked up a drink to the time I took my last one so far. Never have I had a social drink. I drink to get drunk. And so he also explained to me, in the doctor's opinion, it says that these men and women aren't drinking to escape. They're drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And that word craving came up again, and it wasn't a physical thing, because I didn't have the shaky physical craving thing. I had more of that spiritual craving. That craving for the effect produced by a drink of alcohol. And so he explained that to me. And then what he told me was that I didn't have some funky disease that was in the parking lot doing push-ups waiting to kill me. He told me that I had a spiritual malady, that I had this soul sickness, that there was something the matter right in here that alcohol used to fix for me. And when I wasn't drinking that alcohol anymore, all of a sudden that problem happened again. And I got that. I absolutely understood. And then he told me in step two, that I was going to come to believe in this power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And the insanity that he was talking about was the fact that when I'm sober and I know what's going to happen when I pick up a drink, I make the decision to drink anyway because I have no power of choice in drink. And so I was going to come up with this power that would restore me to sanity over that compulsion to drink alcohol. And I didn't want to talk to him about God, and he was an atheist / agnostic, and he didn't want to talk about it either. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of Paul Mattson, as I very frequently misunderstood him, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hung out in here with you guys, and I did what I was told. And Paul and I, we went through that inventory. I wrote a 4-step inventory, and I shared it with him, and I did like it talks about in our literature in step 6 and 7. And I prayed for the first time ever that maybe this power that I didn't really believe in was going to take away these defects of character, and I started to make my amends. I had my 8-step list, and I worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, a lot of the stuff that I did in here, I did knowing that it wasn't going to work. And what happened was it worked, and I found myself sober, and I love my life as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been here for a long time, and I've accomplished everything that I wanted to accomplish so far in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got married when I was kind of young in sobriety. I had this little boy. I did it that way first. I had a little boy, and then I got married. And what? And and so this little guy's 22 years old now, and I have another son who's 18, and he's graduating from high school on Wednesday. And you know, the most amazing thing, for me in here is to realize that I came into you guys, this broken, foul-mouthed, wrong little girl who was not comfortable in her own skin and needed a drink of alcohol just to breathe. And today I have these two guys, and I've been a mom to them consistently through their whole life, and I've raised them, and I'm watching them do all of the things that I did. You know, my oldest guy's 22 years old. He enlisted in my Navy. I thought that was the completion of my 9th step. I gave him my eldest born. and off to Iraq he went, and like quick, you know. And so he's over there, and then he's in Bahrain, and then he's in Japan, and then he's drinking, and then he meets the CO, and then he's having NJPs, and then he's in rehab in San Diego, and then he's booted out just like his mama. Proud family tradition we're carrying on. And my little guy, he's 2 years ago, he's failing school. I can't get him to show up to save my frickin' life. You know what I... He does this wake and bake thing where he just, sure you guys know what that means. I've been sober a little too long to figure it out, but I'm catching on quick, damn it. And he's got no credits, and I'm putting him in this continuation school, and I'm like fighting with everything that I've got in me because I know how those continuation schools work, and I don't want him there, you know? And I got these two little boys, and they're living out two different parts of my story, and I'm realizing there's not a doggone thing that I can do about any of it. And it's pretty neat to be able to be on both sides of the spectrum. And I was telling Charlie a couple weeks ago what a great thing it is to be asked to speak in a young people's meeting. Not only because I came in here young, and I don't know about you guys, I'm sure you probably get this, but I was so different before I drank. And then I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was so different. And then these old timers would look at me and they would make me so different. Like, I spilled more down my tie than you ever drank, little missy. And I thought, well, Christ, get it in your mouth and you might have got here sooner, Joe Maxey. What is wrong with you, old man? You know, come on, for real. Like, you still have a wristwatch. You can't be an alcoholic. You might have to go around the block a few more times. And I thought, well, Christ, how big is the block? I'm not going to live. You know what I mean? And I came in here, and those old-timers, they made me different. And I swore I wasn't going to do that to you guys, because I know what it feels like to be different in a room where we need to be the same, where we have to have that common thing. Otherwise, we're all dead. And I love this thing that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I came in here different, and I worked the steps, and I became just like you, even though I was different. And I built this life that was phenomenal, and I married the man of my dreams. You know, like you walk into the dance and the disco ball slows down and your eyes lock from across the room. And really what happened was I watched him with her and he watched me with him. And then we were like, nah! And then, so, well, come on, you know what I'm talking about. So I got married. I'm married 17 and a half years. I have these two amazing kids before they started drinking and getting loaded. And I moved up to Hollister, and I've got this life that's beyond compare, and we're Mr. and Mrs. Frickin' AA, you know what I mean? I'm like 21 years sober, and he's got 18, and everybody comes to our house that we bought with the pool, and we're barbecuing and swimming, and all the little sponsees come over every day, and we're reading the big book and working the steps, and I'm like, you know, like it's a crucifix, and I'm going after Dracula or something with this big book, and I mean, you're getting it whether you want it or not. And I sponsor half of freaking Northern California. I'm like the Clancine of the Central Valley, you know what I mean? And I mean, my life's rocking, and it's everything that I ever dreamed that I could possibly have in here. And all of a sudden, my husband's not coming home at night, and the kid's going off to war, and the little guy's not going to school, and I'm like hanging on for all I am freaking worth. Like, if you guys would just listen to me, I could fix it. You know what I mean? And I wasn't fixing anything. The harder I hung on, the more out of control everything was. And what happened was that husband decided that at 18 years sober, the next step in his spiritual journey in Alcoholics Anonymous was to become a Hell's Angel. And off he rode on his Harley with the bartender at Payne's. And and the kid went off to war, and the little guy's out of control, and I'm dying a day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was, God bless, I hope you guys never, ever, ever get to this point, but I was 21 years sober, and I was so freaking full of myself. I was so full of this spiritual arrogance that I would sit against the wall with my sunglasses on, crying so he couldn't see, so I thought. And I was too prideful to tell you that I was freaking dying and that I didn't know what to do. And I was doing everything that I was taught how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, except turning anything over to a power greater than myself. Because what had happened was that I caught this little resentment against God. And in step 11 in the 12 and 12, it says that sometimes we're seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply refuse to pray. And it talks about when the hand of God seems heavy and sometimes unjust. And what happened was, I've had periods in my life where I've had a deep and profound and meaningful connection with a power greater than myself that you guys gave me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is all because of you, nothing that I do on my own. And then there's times that I wander away because I fancy myself agnostic. I'm full of self-sufficiency and self-reliance, and I freaking got it, and I don't need your help. And every now and then, I got this self-doubt going on. And if on page 68 it says, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, and God resides right here, and I doubt me, then I doubt the power of God that is in me. And so sometimes I can't hook up with that power. And I caught this resentment, and I thought the hand of God was heavy and sometimes unjust, and I turned my back on God, and I set about fixing it. And what happened was I broke everything that was left in my life. I just absolutely decimated it. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about alcoholism. It says, with it goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And because I had one of them sponsor thingies that made me look crap up, I looked up the word annihilate. It says to reduce to nothing. And I did that in Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in the center of you. I reduced everything that mattered to me in my life to nothing. And one more time, I sat in here broken and desperate. And I had to tell you, at 21 years sober with an ego like mine, let me tell you, I can't do this anymore. I need help. And what I did was I drove down to Los Angeles. I live 4.5 hours north of here. And I drove over to this funky freaking mission on 6th and San Pedro. You know where this is going, right? And I sat across from this cantankerous old man named Clancy Emisland. And I told him, I'm dying in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will do absolutely anything that you tell me to do, and I won't argue with you, I won't question with you, I won't debate you, just please, you got to help me because I'm dying. And so Clancy's my sponsor, and every Wednesday I drive to my home group, which is the Pacific Group on Sunset Boulevard in Saltaire. It takes me 4.5 or 5 hours. I come down on Wednesday, I have lunch with my sponsor, I go to PG, and then I hang out for a couple days, and then I go home and do this mom thingy with my kids. And what happened was slowly I started rebuilding my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, one more time, it is absolutely everything that I dreamed possible for me I have in my life today. And I got to tell you, it's not the Cadillac outside, and it's not the house that I used to own, and it's not the 780 credit rating, and it's not all of the things that I thought were so important, the career and the things. It's all about these two little boys at home that I get to be a service to because God put them in my life for a reason, and I'm their mom. And I promised them when they were little teeny tiny babies that I would do absolutely anything that I could to help these kids and to make sure they had anything they wanted in their life. And I do that today. And I stopped fighting the idea of God because one day I was looking at these boys and I was loving them with every freaking fiber of my being. I love them so much it hurts. And I realized, like, what if this power greater than myself that you guys are trying to connect me to loves me just like that? What if he's just my pops and he loves me just like that? And today that's pretty much how I pray. And I pray to my dad. And I, like Chuck Chamberlain used to do, get up every morning and say, hey, Dad, it's me, and I'm reporting for duty, and please use me today in whatever way you see fit. And at the end of the day, I go back through my day, and I hope something I did today makes you smile. And that's about as deep and profound as it needs to get for me. You know, I'm going to close with this. I had 13 years sober. I had destroyed my lumbar spine and had this huge surgery that left me with nerve damage in my back, and I was put on Social Security permanent disability, and I'm fighting it. I lost my job. We lost our house. We just lost. And at the end of it, I was on this cruise ship, and I was standing on the deck of this cruise ship. It was the most profound, surreal moment that I had had in 13 years of sobriety. There was a full moon, and there were all these clouds. The moon was kind of peeking out between them, The moon was reflecting off of the wake that the ship was throwing, and there were like diamonds everywhere. And it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. It was the night of my 13th birthday, and I had on this beautiful formal dress, and I had my hair all done up and my makeup done, and I looked pretty. And I don't know about you guys, but that's always something I have a problem with because I like beat myself up. But I looked really pretty, and I was standing on the deck of the ship, and I was talking to all those old timers. They were around when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you guys won't remember any of these names, although if you go up to the archives that Jerry's got on the second floor, you'll see their pictures. And there was Frank Priest, and there was my sponsor, Paul Mattson. And there's Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Dick, whose wife Carol is over there in the banquet this evening. And all of these old-timers that I loved so much, and I was talking to them, and I was thanking them for my life. And I was telling them, like, whoever thought 13 years ago when I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous, foul-mouthed and dirty and homeless and broken, and absolutely believing that my life was over and I deserved nothing good in my life because I had just blown it all to smithereens. Whoever would have thought that 13 years later I'd be standing on the deck of this cruise ship going on a cruise to Ensenada, Mexico, and I'd have 13 years sober, and I'd have these two amazing kids at home, and this man that I love more than life itself, and they're closing the casino, which is a whole nother program, and whoever would have thought? And just like they were standing on the deck of the ship, I could hear each one of them say, like, oh my God, we did, baby. You know, what happened was I came in here desperate, and you saw in me a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you looked at me, and you saw a wife, and you saw a mother. You saw a sponsor and a sponsee and a daughter and a everything that I thought that I could never, ever be. And it's almost like you breathed them into my very being, like you created me from nothing. I really believe that to be true. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we see things in you that, oh my God, you can't possibly see for yourself. If you just stay in here and you do these things that we do a day at a time. And my life is beyond compare. You know, that husband left and I went through this divorce, and I, at 21 and a half years sober, contemplated taking my own life because I thought, like, I can't even freaking breathe anymore, and I'm certainly not going to drink because then what'll they say? Because it's all about spirituality and humility. So I was hanging on for all I was worth, and I got this new sponsor, and I started doing the things that I did when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And today what I know is I don't get to stay sober on what I did yesterday in AA. It's all about today and that daily reprieve that we have contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I love my life today in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm rebuilding it from the ground up. And I have a relationship in my life that is beyond compare. It's phenomenal. And I thought, like, that was just done, and I was just going to be a mom and raise my kids and whatever, whatever, but it's all good. It's so all good, you know, and I have friends in my life that, that go to the mat for me. You know what I mean? My husband left, and I had people asking me if I needed him buried. And they meant it. Then I thought about it. But I have this life today that I never ever dreamed possible for myself, and it's all a result of sticking around in here with you guys and doing what we do. And if you're new in here, I hope you stay. And if you're old in here, my God, I hope you stay. You know what they told me was, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happened. And at 21 years sober, what I realized is I can't leave 5 minutes after the miracle happens either, because the miracle stops when I'm not in here with you. It really does. And so I'm a little bit late, but I'd really like to thank the committee for allowing me the opportunity to come and speak here at this roundup. Like I said, this is my home gig, and there's nothing like it. Thank you so much for my life.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.